Coming up on this week's Redcast.
The tone at the top has got to change. And I think the SPV thing has made me think of this again. Maybe they were, taking some of the good and leaving some other bits, like their asset liability management, maybe not so much.
Very apparent from the conversations I have with industry peers that data and functional teams are still operating very much within those silos.
Tell me, Mr. Regulator, what is good enough? What am I going to get to? What am I going to have to do to satisfy you that I'm getting my fundamentals correct? And the unfortunate reality is that there is anything and nothing the firm can do which will mean it will be getting the fundamentals wrong.
Regulators want it now. They know that the data exists. They want banks to actually spend the money, to bring this all together.
So I think it's incumbent upon the industry or industries and key stakeholders and groups, working groups or industry groups and bodies to help drive that agenda around common domain model, right?
And so maybe we just saw our first case where they'll actually be comfortable finding people or having real consequences from the SMCR regime.
Welcome to Redcast.
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 Redcast. Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today. Hello, I'm PJ, CEO and founder of JWG, and welcome to Season 3, Episode 4 of Redcast. It's Monday the 13th, in advance of our 22nd of March training seminar. We have tomorrow's Integrated Risk Management Radar on the menu. And what more prescient thing to be talking about, and what a reminder of how important integrated risk is than all of the shenanigans we saw with the Silicon Valley Bank over this weekend. So just to tee this up, the picture is still emerging, and Silicon Valley Bank recently really spooked the market in the US in a much different way than it did here in the UK, because there are 3,300 clients that over the weekend were being contacted by HM Treasury, and all the Sunday show discussion was about, well, would they continue to trade? How would that happen? Ultimately, for the whopping sum of £1, HSBC now owns all those client relationships. But importantly, tens of billions have been wiped off the market value of banks. And I think if anything brings back the importance of this issue, it's how do we think about the safety and security of the banking system and the way we think about risk management. Now, certainly you could assert that the regulator should have been able to figure some of this out. And I think there are a lot of people pointing some interesting fingers, and there are two legal entities here, right? One in the US and one in the UK that's a separate entity, but obviously functionally managed in a different way and supervised in a different way. So it leads us on to this question of integrated risk management that has long been a dream that's made sense, but the problems of getting there are really, have been difficult for a number of years. And it's something the Financial Conduct Authority has been on about since 2017, in terms of thinking about getting a common view of the risk processes, getting all the data on the same page, getting your silos to be able to pick up market abuse, as well as anti-money laundering, as well as a number of other risk classes, and just functionally having fewer disconnects across the way that we look at all the various risks out there. So this dream requires a lot of joined up thinking, and it requires a lot of data, and it requires a lot of ways to think about getting manual processes to play better today. And ultimately, it's going to mean a whole different way of thinking about standards across the middle and the back office. So the thing on tomorrow's radar today is, what is this wake-up call that we're coming to today? What kind of benchmarks and prudential and conduct will be required in the future? And how are we going to use standards to get off of PDFs and into code? And that'll help us all align on what good looks like. So we would like to dive into not the prudential side of that, but the conduct side of this today. And who better to help us than a conduct risk guru and newly minted head of an electronic platform compliance function, a global finance whiz who knows regulation and technology, and a cross-border M&A financial services lawyer who helps high-frequency traders. May I please ask Richard, could you introduce yourself?
Thanks, PJ. My name is Richard Bain. I'm a senior compliance officer for State Street and responsible for the electronic exchange and digital asset business.
Thanks very much. And welcome back to RegCast, Richard. You're not a stranger to these shores.
No, season pro.
Sam.
Oh, thank you, PJ. I am the M&A lawyer in question, and I also a seasoned hack at RegCast. I believe, actually, I was on the first one.
You were. Many moons ago. So thank you and welcome back. And Paul, I think this is your first one, but welcome. Why don't you give it the telephone?
I think it's my second or third, PJ, so not my first radio, right. But anyway.
Sorry, it is your second.
Never mind. And looking forward to many more. My name's Paul Cotty. I'm based in the New York City area, and I'm a director in the product team at NICE. And our product team is focused on fighting financial crime, or providing the platforms to help fight financial crime.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for joining. I think the first question on the agenda is really, what is pushing risk management to be more integrated this year? Richard, you're sitting closest to the coal faces. What do you see?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think there are a number of commercial imperatives that are driving an integrated risk management solution. As much as there are operational and just efficiency gains that can be had. But I think as we're approaching a financial climate that probably requires many firms to tighten their belts, I think having an integrated risk management function that can operate and manage risk effectively, but perhaps in a lean way, is going to be highly critical to the firm's financial performance moving forward. So I think that's the driver, and I think PJ, just to touch on, I think some of the key themes of areas to focus on for the next sort of 12 months from my perspective are, and you've touched on one of them already, which is data, right? And the reality is it's that to achieve an integrated risk management function, we have to begin to stop operating in silos. And it's very apparent from the conversations I have with industry peers that data and functional teams are still operating very much within those silos. And if I look at the far end of the spectrum, you know, if data is sort of foundational and I look at the outcomes of those data and those compliance and risk management programs, I think being able to have an enterprise-wide view of the risks and the issues that your programs are producing is fundamental. And so at that end of the scale, what we're still seeing is disaggregated management reports. So there's very few firms that are actually able to look at, let's say, financial crime risk holistically, which includes bribery, AML, sanctions, market abuse. There's a lot of management reporting going into the executive committees that oversee these risks. However, invariably, they're isolated management reports that cover any one of those particular topics. They're not able to see that holistically across that family of risk, if you like. So I actually think, you know, breaking down silos, integrating data is foundational and key. And I think that should help us achieve a better output and ability to see risk at an enterprise level. I also think within that, across the whole infrastructure and operation that makes up, you know, whether it be surveillance, compliance, risk management, I think there's an awful lot of optimization that can be done there, actually. And there's lots of wins that can be achieved. And I'd like to see much more sort of common domain model conversation around how firms and industry solve some of these challenges within that wide array of infrastructure and operation that we can achieve some efficiency gains on and actually produce better outcomes. So I think for me, that's where I'd start. I think you've got the foundation, which is data, knocking, breaking down silos, better outcomes and better overview of risk from a management information perspective. And then within that, I think there's a number of verticals and layers that you can start to look at getting incremental gains in within the operation of the compliance and risk management program more broadly.
And what's the real thing that's new for you, Richard? I guess, you know, I look at some of these FCA speeches going back to 2017, and I see many of those same themes about needing to link things together and you know, be able to get a more holistic view. What's different in 2023?
Well, look, I think what's different in 2023, if I look back at what we saw from the enforcement action and that regulatory guidance that came out in 2022, is for me, there's almost two competing parts here, right? You've got running the day-to-day bank from a risk and compliance management standpoint. And then you've got a change component, right? How do you move towards a more optimal, more risk-weighted, or even indeed just more efficient and more cost-effective compliance and risk management organization? And so you've got this sort of dual balance between change the bank and run the bank, if you like, in that sense. And it appears to me, if you actually over-tilt in any one of those particular disciplines, or what I see a lot of in the industry, you try to have the same teams of individuals manage activity across both of those disciplines, you tend to lose sight and effectiveness of one. If we look at the Citibank were fined $12.6 million by the FCA. If you look at that fine, and if you look at some of the Market Watch guidance that's came out from the FCA, a lot of that was focused around not getting the fundamentals right. Things like risk assessments, controls and testing, policies, procedures. It wasn't necessarily about actually driving towards complex change and the use of AI and machine learning and better models, albeit that's important to get you to that end destination. So for me, I think firms that are able to balance those two competing requirements of change and run, I think will be the firm that are doing that well will be well serviced and will probably not fall foul of some of the mistakes that we've seen in the sort of just the fundamental application of compliance and risk management basics, where we've seen regulatory enforcement action in the last 12 months.
And I guess that enforcement agenda is so key. Sam, you're on the sharp edge of people getting pulled up by the regulator. What's your perspective on this year's priorities?
Well, first, and rather boringly, I should say that I agree with everything Richard's just said, and for the reasons that he set them out. But to your question about what is different in 2023 compared to 22 or 21, there are a number of issues which are not new, but they are evolving, and they're becoming more critical, which means, as far as I'm concerned, that integration of risk management across the silos is becoming increasingly important. I made a nice long list of them, but the headlines are the way that financial institutions need to communicate internally and with their clients and what's expected. So you've got social media, you've got all the different ways that information will be disseminated and received, which is partly because of the rise of the retail markets and the importance of the retail markets and those who deal with or all of those particular types of clients, which follows then into the fact that we have an increasing number of markets and market players. So we've got crypto, we've got emerging different types of asset class, some of which are already financial instruments under the rules, some of which are not, some of which may be, depending on whether you squint and how you're feeling during the day, and how all of those are interconnected. And it's becoming more and more difficult and therefore more and more pressing to understand how all of those different factors are connected with one another. And it does go a certain way to explaining regulators' views that firms should, in order to get the fundamentals right, to use Richard's phrase, have a complete view of their entire offering and their entire interaction with the markets and the consumers. And without, internally within organizations, the silos talking to one another, collecting data in the same format, which is then interoperable, that becomes very difficult. I am going to say that the desire for regulators to see firms getting the fundamentals correct, whilst understandable, is also a challenge for firms, because who knows what getting the fundamentals correct is so far as the regulator is concerned. I see it a lot in the UK, and it's something I've been standing on my little soapbox and shouting for a long time, is please tell me, Mr. Regulator, what is good enough? What am I going to get to, what am I going to have to do to satisfy you that I'm getting my fundamentals correct? And the unfortunate reality is that there is anything and nothing that a firm can do which will mean it will be getting the fundamentals wrong. So the more data it has at its fingertips as board MI or as part of automated or manual surveillance processes, the more defensible their position becomes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's well put. A lot of this is about justifying your position vis-a-vis peers or a perception of what good looks like. And that hasn't really been forthcoming, though. Paul, I guess you've been part of these kind of conversations for yonks. What are you seeing changing in terms of how, you know, this whole notion of the fundamentals?
I'll just go back to that. Thanks, PJ. I'll just go back to that last point. I'm looking down, so forgive me for not looking into the camera. I've been looking at my notes. I've been furiously writing as Richard and Sam have been talking. Just on the point about getting the fundamentals correct, I think what the regulators might have been trying to say, in especially the FCA in various parts of its output, is this may differ from bank to bank. But underlying that, there should be a common layer, if you like, and I think that's where the question goes to. From my own experience, from when I was working in banking, I actually asked this question of a regulator when I was sort of new to surveillance, and surveillance as a discipline was fairly new, and this is, you know, 12, 13, 14 years ago now. And I actually said to a regulator to their face, I said, it was actually an exchange operator who'd come to audit us. And I said, well, you know, can you give me some guidance here? Can you tell me what you want me to be looking for and covering off at a bare minimum? You know, what concerns you as the market operator? And their head of compliance said to my face, I'm not going to tell you that. And I'm like, huh? I said, well, how do you expect me to make sure that you know I'm helping you to keep your market transparent and integrity and all that? And he said, you've got the rules. That's your minimum set, and you know it's up to you to make sure that you think you're covering off against the rules, and that you can convince me that you're covering off against the rules. He said in a quieter moment. He said, look, regulators. In his view, I can't remember, I'm paraphrasing, but he said regulators generally shy away from sort of saying exactly what, you know, getting into the detail of what good enough is, because they don't want to constrain themselves. They don't want someone coming back saying, well, you said that this was good enough and there's been a blow up, and you know, they still want to have they want to retain the right to be able to ping you, even if what they said yesterday, you know, you're doing a good enough job, and then today you're not. They want to be able to ping you at the end of the day, and then Sam, they, you know, the firm will come to you and enlist your helps. But if I can pick up on a couple of points that Richard and Sam make, I think with respect to change, you know, PJ, you've asked what's changed between 2017 and 2023. I think there has been a lot of communication from the regulators, and again with the FCA in particular. And I think you mentioned speeches back in 2017. I think you're probably referring to some of the speeches that Julia Hoggett made, and I think she was pretty clear, you know, then and into 2018 and beyond. There's a distinct thread in a lot of her speeches, you know, coming up with the, you know, compliance as a state of mind and things like this that she was saying. But I think what's changed, so that's a constant. I think what's changed is the pandemic, obviously, that jump started what was already happening, and that is access to data. Suddenly, you know, the regulators have figured out there are these masses of data, and when they were unable to go around and do, you know, over the shoulder, looking over the shoulder type visits, they became totally dependent on data to an extent that I think they'd never had before. And I think, again, we've seen with the FCA, they've really ramped up in the last 2-3 years their data crunching abilities. So I think a huge amount has come back to data. The problem with that is, and going back to what Richard said about finding a balance, there's the possibility of too much management information and manage just this black hole of data. I sometimes think back to you know, sometimes maybe simplicity, or going for simplicity is the key. I think it's an apocryphal story that I can't remember the name of the person, but I think the CEO of JP Morgan back in the day, you know, it was 35 years or so ago when value at risk was invented. That person, that CEO, wanted to have by 8:15 every morning, they wanted to have a single number which represented the risk across the firm. So you can't get more siloed than that, more integrated than that. And that was the birth of value at risk. So it was taking a lot and boiling it down into a single data point. And maybe that's the holy grail. I, to be a bit cynical here, I do think that sometimes banks can get, you know, look at things on a holistic basis. Anyone who's worked in a bank will be able to tell a story of you know, coming up to bonus time, and then a missive comes out from senior management saying, "Oh, bonuses are slashed this year because our, you know, mortgage derivatives desk had a real shocking year, and so that's affecting everyone's bonuses." But then when we come to something like what we're talking about, you know, surveillance and compliance and so on, they still haven't been able to look at on an enterprise wide basis. So I'm taking up a lot of time here. So,
no, I think there's some great points there. And I guess there is this natural desire to want to boil it up to a number. And if you're a 4.2, you're below. And if you're 4.3, you're okay. But Sam, I guess, you know, reflecting on what you've seen in the press recently over the Silicon Valley Bank discussion, how do some of these risk conversations play out in terms of real things that, you know, have real consequences in the market?
I think we risk, when we talk about that, tripping over into the prudential treatment of a balance sheet and liabilities, because it strikes me that this is mainly a prudential issue and a balance sheet management treasury point from Silicon Valley, particularly. Because of the way that, you know, they ran their business and where the deposits made their way onto Silicon Valley's balance sheet. Nonetheless, you know, if we want to talk a little bit more generally about conduct, we could mention the very recent payment of annual bonuses. And the acts and omissions of some of the senior management, which, without talking as to the whys and wherefores or the advisability or otherwise of taking those actions, all do go down to how seriously a firm takes the risk profile that it has in the market. And to use the FCA's phrase, it's a culture of compliance and culture of conduct and generally being a good actor. And if board MI was available, showing that there was a cliff edge due to whatever prudential factors there were, then you know, maybe the board would have taken a different decision, not paid bonuses, not decided to sell its stock. And there would be more skin in the game at this point. What the relationship was or is between the US parents and the UK sub, I can't talk to. The PRA and the FCA was very clear a few years ago that Silicon Valley needed to subsidiarize their UK operations, and seems that that was a very good thing.
And does that mean they're subject then to the senior management regime?
Yes. And also, although we're not talking about the prudential rules, a different set of prudential rules. It's ring fenced within the subsidiary itself. But yes, absolutely. Everyone's subject to the conduct rules.
Well, maybe we just saw our first case where they'll actually be comfortable finding people or having real consequences from the SMCR regime. Richard, just you were speaking about all the management information, lots of metrics, and need to get it more simplified. And I think the conversation has helped elaborate that. How would this risk framework help with conduct that you're looking for? We have plenty of examples out there, you know, like the Financial Market Standards Board, who's created a series of things one ought to be looking for as risk types, for example. But you know, there's also then a whole bunch of literature on how do you manage conduct. Help us understand from your point of view, if you're looking for efficiency, what does having a common domain model do for you?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the things that Paul touched on, right? You can go and ask the regulator. The regulator's not going to give you a direct answer as to what good looks like. So I think it's incumbent upon the industry or industries and key stakeholders and groups, working groups or industry groups and bodies to help drive that agenda around common domain model, right? And so, you know, we've got, I think Paul also said, like, I mean, how risk manifests within your business is fundamentally different bank to bank, organization to organization. But actually, a lot of the methods and the risk behaviors or risk typologies you look for are fundamentally the same, right? And so I can't tell you though, PJ, how many times I speak to people in industry or colleagues in industry, and you know, you'll ask them about a wash trade, or you'll ask them about particular sanctions risk, and there's very little alignment on what a wash trade is or what particular sanctions risk is, right? But which is really kind of quite bizarre if you think about it, because as I say, while that might manifest in your business fundamentally differently, a wash trade is a wash trade, right? It doesn't matter where it happens or how it happens, that's what it is, right? I mean, so I think what we could do certainly is start, you know, and there has been work in this space. Where, say, we've seen risk taxonomies come out from the Financial Market Standards Board. So that's a good foundational piece, right, where it says, actually, we've done the analysis, we've done the behavioral cluster analysis, and these are the risks that you're looking for. These are the risks that are inherent in a particular risk sphere, right, that we expect market and industry to focus on. The next piece is, okay, so, well, actually, how do you actually start to build out what good looks like there in terms of surveillance, right? And so I think that conversation is very nascent, if I'm being honest, and perhaps hasn't evolved or as matured as quickly as we would have liked. But it's, you know, I don't think there's a necessity for firms to go on their own. Look, I think there's a lot of market watch material out there or equivalent from other national competent authorities that you can look at. You should have a program of routinely reviewing enforcement actions and translating them into your own environment. So that you can get a sense of what, whether or not that's a realistic, you know, that's realistically something that can happen within your own domain. I also think, you know, and again, just coming, you know, sort of back to sort of fundamentals. I mean, again, there's a plethora of different approaches out there in the industry to things like risk assessment, things like management information, escalation channels, governance frameworks. Like, to some extent, a lot of that doesn't need to be what, you know, unique to the firms. You can actually start to do some level of standardization across those types of things as well, right? And so I think there'll be more work to do there, and I'd like to see, you know, the industry and relevant stakeholders be much more collaborative in that approach.
Yeah, fantastic. I think just coming on to our 22nd of March agenda, that's a seminar where we're pulling a lot of the experts together to get their different perspectives across the various panels. I'd like to start with Paul, just in terms of what's the key thing on that message, the message you're looking for on the 22nd that, you know, help that will help engage people from the industry to come pay attention. What's your main message?
How long is a piece of string? Sorry?
60 seconds.
I'll try and get it done in less than that. I think there's my main message is that you regulators at the moment, there's actually a lot going on. The market abuse stuff is all fine and well, and I think they're continuing to roll out fines from time to time when someone thinks that they're, you know, that they're new to the market and they think they can, no one's ever done spoofing before, and they'll get picked up on that. But I think we are in a bit of a generational change in the industry at the moment. There is all that data around that I mentioned before. You know, the regulators are pushing for a holistic view of conduct risks, but conduct risk as a discipline. It's funny because I can sometimes, when people talk about, oh, you know, we'll look at badge swipes and things like that, I think back to a case in 1996 of insider trading in Australia. So even doing things like that is not new, but that data has been around for a long time. But it took the Australian regulator back then, took them months to come up with this, and regulators want it now. They know that the data exists. They want banks to actually spend the money, you know, to bring this all together. And we've heard that directly from the regulators back last, you know, late last year when the fines for the record keeping came out of the SEC and the CFTC. One of the commissioners from the CFTC was very clear on this. You know, they were basically bringing all these fines out in a single hit to make a splash. They wanted to make a splash in the market, and they were saying, And this commissioner said, you know, the change at the top, the tone at the top has got to change. And I think the SPV thing has made me think of this again. One of the other things she said was, you can't be a bank, for example, in the United States, and you know, take the good parts of the regulatory environment and then throw some other, I can't remember exactly what she said, but then choose to ignore some others. You know, she was saying, if you want the protection that being a bank provides for you, and you want the good side of the regulation, then you got to take the bits that might cost you a bit of money as well, and take a bit of time and management effort. And I think, you know, that may be where some of the issue comes down with the recent banks. We've seen, not to cast any aspersions on individuals, but maybe they were you know, taking some of the good and leaving some other bits, like their asset liability management, maybe not so much. So
thank you, yeah. Paul. I think that you've done a good job creating a nice fearful environment. Sam, what's your key message for the 22nd?
My key message, following on from Paul's, was I've got two: behavioral analysis and gap analysis. I'll start with the gap analysis because it follows on from what Paul's saying. Too often, it's a question of firms undertaking a gap analysis to find out the difference between their current operations and what their operations need to look like under new rules or emerging rules, and going out of their way to interpret the rules so that they can continue doing what they're already doing. That's not possible in most circumstances. And the second is behavioral analysis, which is much broader. If you divide that into two, you've got internal behavioral analysis and external behaviors. And Richard and I have been on a number of working groups with UPG where we've talked about behavioral analysis. The issue or the difficulty for firms looking at the behavior of their own staff is that in order to get a broad overview and a broad understanding of how your staff are behaving and their conduct, there's a lot of information about your staff that firms just do not want access to. I'm sure banks and everyone else doesn't want to read my personal texts to my wife about how much we have to spend on a dishwasher.
Yeah, there's a whole series of additional issues that need to be considered as part of this.
Exactly. And as far as external behaviors are concerned, the line of travel for them from the FCA in the UK has been and will remain that behavioral biases for customers and potential customers is something that firms should take account of when deciding what products and services to offer to them or to continue to provide to them. And that's a really, really big ask. And it's one that firms are undoubtedly going to struggle with. And it comes down to what is the average man in the street able to comprehend so far as a risk disclosure or a disclaimer is concerned. If you have to assume that it's
Sam, speaking of man on the street, we're in danger of losing the audience here with the number of minutes we're taking to do the 1 minute summary. Richard, final 60 seconds over to you.
Yeah, so look, I mean, make sure you focus on the fundamentals. Get your policies, your risk assessment procedures, your controls, your reg office inventories. Make sure that you're doing all of those fundamentals well, and that you can, they're fundamentally driving the capability of your compliance program. Two, we have to break down silos, we have to integrate, and we have to be able to look at risk more holistically. I spoke to a recent Federal Reserve executive, and they said your compliance and your risk program should be able to root line corners. To do that, we're going to have to break down those walls that make up those corners. So that would be the two things I'd say, PG.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's been a pleasure to go through this with you guys. I know it's real-time analysis and we're getting this out on a Monday, but by the time it comes out on Wednesday, I'm sure it'll be a lot of information to process. But we look forward to wrapping it all up on the 22nd. And thank you for joining us then. There's a registration process to get into. It'll be in your inbox or out on the website. We've had 20,000 downloads of these Redcasts so far. Thank you for liking them, whatever platform you're on, and you throw a comment on that helps us attract more people and find out what the market wants. Let us know if there's something in particular you want us to be talking about. We have new seminars being announced shortly once we're past the 22nd, and looking forward to keeping the radar up to date for you. Thanks very much.
You can download the podcast via Spotify, Apple, and Google, but also I'd encourage people to come to the JWG website, which, as hopefully you will know, is jwg-it.eu. Go to the Intelligence Hub and create your bespoke library.
This is Redcast.
Tomorrow's RegTech Radar today.